Hey, everybody. Welcome to the full Judiciary Committee in the House. Want to welcome you all here on this warmest day of the year, I'm told. We are going to start with a hearing on Senate Bill 83. And I'll open that hearing and invite Senator Peter Courtney, a graduate of Boston University Law School, a man who did his undergrad at University of Rhode Island, I understand. Welcome, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator from District 17, Salem-Keizer. And I looked different when I was younger. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 83. I'm a bit shaken because both Representative Backlund and Representative Wilson have commented on a picture of me that they recently seen about, just emotionally, you know, when people talk about how you look today versus how you used to look, that can be shattering if they do it in a way that's not complimentary. So I got to get my composure back because it was just done moments ago by, you know, your members of your committee, Mr. Chair. This bill, Mr. Chair, would say that within 1,000 feet of a school, if you are guilty of disorderly conduct as decided by a police officer, instead of it being a Class B, it's a Class A misdemeanor. That's all it does. Why does it do it within 1,000 feet? Because we already use 1,000 feet to say you can't have a methadone clinic within 1,000 feet of a school. I think that was a pretty light decision we made. I mean, that makes sense. You can't manufacture, deliver, or possess controlled substances within 1,000 feet of school. And we also have another bill out there that passed several sessions ago that says that if you violate certain traffic offenses around the school, you'll get double the fine. So 1,000 feet is this bill that says disorderly conduct. Why that? The principals in my school districts, particularly North and Sprague, have come to me over the last several years and have asked me to do something about individuals, gangbangers, even in some cases where they actually had sex offenders. They asked to leave the building and to please move back away far enough so that they wouldn't be making associations with the students. They've also had some instances during other activities in school property. The buffer zone, in effect, would therefore basically say, if you're going to conduct yourself in a disorderly way to the extent that it rises to this kind of conduct, we're going to say you're going to get hit harder in these areas. The bill did pretty well in the Senate. It did both in the Judiciary Committee and the Senate floor. It's simply a piece of legislation that says that when it comes to public safety and conduct, we would like to say around our schools, there's certain things that you should observe. The bill is very simple, very straightforward. As they say, it was brought to me by, and I'm not saying that only the principals in my areas are having a problem, but the ones here are having enough problems that they felt that they would ask for some kind of protection like this. Will it have a major impact? I don't know. Will it make a major difference? I don't know. But it does comply with what we've done in the past. We've attempted to try to help schools and make them safer places for all of our kids to attend. As they say, it is a decision to be made by a police officer and only a police officer. It's disorderly conduct as defined in law now. We did not try to come up with a new definition of disorderly conduct. We stuck with the old definition. And with that, Mr. Chair, because you have many other individuals in this office and many other other individuals in the room as well as bills, I won't take much more of your time. This bill was up before, and I know you didn't get to it. I appreciate you allowing me even to hear the bill to this early this morning. So that's the bill, straightforward. I did not ask legions of superintendents and principals to come in to testify with that time of the session that unless I get a signal, I don't do that. So if you need a whole lot more support from people who have to live with schools, be principals of schools, work with our kids, deal with the everyday business of schools, I'm sure we can bring them in. But at this time, Mr. Chair, I've chosen not to do that in deference to your incredible heavy load as well as the workload of every member of this committee.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Is there questions for Senator Courtney?
No.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You noticed that Senator Courtney's voice started to elevate because I opened my bill file and looked at the bill and my eyebrows went way up to the top of my head. I was just a little concerned about what's defined as disorderly conduct in the bill, Senator. I know you didn't change it, but it's things like fighting, unreasonable noise. What's unreasonable noise? And you want to elevate that to a $5,000 fine and send people to jail for a year?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, the statute that you're reading from is existing law. There's nothing new in terms of what is disorderly conduct. That's already the statute. So what's unreasonable noise, the police officers in the Eugene Springfield area today, they already are deciding what's unreasonable noise. They, people in the Tigard, Beaverton, Tualatin area, the people, the police officers in Kaiser, the police officers in Multnomah County and in Portland, they already, down where the cavemen are in Grants Pass, they already are making a decision on the basis of what is unreasonable noise. I am not coming up with new words here, Representative Walker. This is our statute that exists. I did not mess around with the sanctity of Oregon's disorderly conduct law, and I mean that, Representative Walker.
Well,
so that is a judgment call that the law enforcement community will make that decision given the situation they come upon.
I understand that, Senator. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
But you want to elevate it to a higher level of misdemeanor.
That's correct.
Okay. I just have concerns about that one.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative Walker, and I would expect you to. I do want to point out that Springfield High School and Thurston High School and Churchill High School and South Eugene High School,
don't
just to mention
mine.
A few.
Sheldon.
I was coming to Sheldon. Sheldon High School.
Home of the Irish, Senator. Home of the Irish.
All those high schools are situations where their principals labor every day with difficult members of the community that come up to literally, because of the fact that it's public property, right up almost into the hallways or right outside the door, they can stay there. And in effect, these individuals, in terms of trying to deal with their everyday job, I agree that this isn't dramatically increasing it, but it's increasing enough maybe to send a signal that when you mess with our schools within 1,000 feet, there is a safety zone. We already have in law 1,000 feet surrounding every one of the high schools in your area and my high schools regarding prohibitions. In addition, we already have in law that if I mess around your schools at a certain speed and I get cited, I'm in deep trouble in terms of the fine. So all I'm doing here is trying to make the safety zone that much safer, and that's much more significant. I am not trying to do anything dramatic here in terms of constitutional law, ACLU law, civil liberties law. I don't even mean to get emotional, but
I
really like Representative Walker, but there's this thing, you know, you got to get into it. You got to get focused and get into it.
We appreciate it. Yes, Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm looking at the bill and a person commits the crime. Now, are you including then that person to include students who are at that school? Because there are many, many school regulations pertaining to fighting and other things that are mentioned specifically in the bill.
It's conceivable a student could commit the crime. I mean, if they were out there and conducting themselves in a way that they meet the definition of disorderly conduct, they could be cited. It's conceivable.
So this would supersede then the school district's policy on fighting, for example.
Well, I don't.
Is that good? Is that what you wanted?
What was that excuse, Mr. Chair?
Well, the school districts have their own policies relating to all kinds of disciplinary situations, including fighting. And so this bill would then elevate or supersede, most likely, the school district policy or the school board policy. Would you agree?
Chair Williams, Representative Backlund, it's very possible. What will happen here ordinarily is a principal will call the police. Now, it seems to me that you're dealing with your own students. You have what they call a vice principal of the school. It is my understanding that the VP of the school is the disciplinarian, and often that's how you would handle a situation with your own students. But to be very honest with you, technically speaking, a student could be cited under this law. The situation brought to me by the principals of North and Sprague, as well as other high schools, are they had students or people who should have been in school, young people, coming onto their campus, creating a problem for the kids that were in their schools or leaving their school, or, you know, that's the situation they were involved in. But I must answer your question, they could be cited, but principals basically use their VPs, and I only say vice principals, I don't know McNary. Yeah, I do know McNary. That's the disciplinarian, that's the person that goes out and says, you guys better cut this out, or else these are the policies you're going to be in violation of.
Further questions? Representative Dingfelter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, would this cover, especially on line 23? Would this cover charter schools as well?
It's my opinion, Chair Williams, Representative Dingfelder, the answer is yes. I'd look to learn in high counsel for another statement, but I believe that that line 23, Representative Dingfelder, would cover charter schools, as it would cover a school called Blanchett.
Learned at high counsel.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, I agree with the good senator.
Now, that's good. Yes. You see, well, that's good.
Are there further questions for Senator Courtney?
Wait a minute, I'm getting... Oh, no, don't do this. No, there's distractions in my life.
We're aware of that, Senator. anything else for Senator Courtney? Senator, we appreciate it. We're always honored when a graduate from Boston University Law School appears in front of our committee.
Thank you very much.
We'll now close the hearing on Senate Bill 83. We have two other members from the House of Lords with us today, and I want to get them up here. I'm going to go ahead and open a quick hearing. We'll come back to it for the rest of the people who've signed up, but I want to show courtesy to my counterpart in the Senate, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator John Minnis. I'm going to open up a hearing on Senate Bill 437. Welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate you allowing me the courtesy of testifying on Senate Bill 437. I wanted to just come and, tell you that this particular bill, in my opinion, is a very important bill. You're going to hear a lot of opposition to this bill, which has risen since it has come out of my committee over to the House. You'll hear some opposition from psychiatrists and some from psychologists and some of the other professional organizations. But what the bill is intended to do is to simply allow a professional to provide information to the prosecutors in the event that someone discloses to them some particular future intent to commit a crime. Now, the bill, as it came out of the out of the Senate, is more general than what you'll hopefully be considering today, and that's the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment will narrow the bill as it came out of the Senate to indicate that one of these professionals may provide information that's been disclosed to them by one of their clients where there's a clear intent to commit a crime involving physical injury, a threat to physical safety of any person, sexual abuse, or death. And I just wanted to come in and share with your committee that there are, from time to time, situations that occur where a psychologist or a psychiatrist or professional who has this particular privilege in Chapter 40 of the Oregon Revised Statute may receive information that they may want to disclose to the prosecutor. What this bill does is allow them to do it. It does not compel them to do it. It simply allows them to do this. The amendment that you'll be seeing today, the A3 amendment, goes even further than the bill did as it came out of the Senate and provides that that a person who discloses a communication described in subsection 1 of this section is not liable to any other person for any damages or injury arising out of disclosure. And if I understand correctly, this particular A3 amendment was the product of a work group between some individuals, the principals on this bill, Karen Emmergut and John Bradley from the Multnomah County DA's office and the Oregon State Bar. So, it's amazing how nervous you get when you come in and speak in front of another committee like this. It's probably good for me to come in and do this because I have the opportunity to sit on the other side of the diocese and ask questions and so on and so forth. But I think it's a good bill. I think it's a good exception to the hearsay rule because I do think that there are, again, situations from time to time where this information provided to prosecutors can be helpful, particularly where there's a disclosure of an intent to commit a future crime. And my experience as a police detective, from time to time you do run into individuals who are what you might consider psychosexual killers or individuals who have a particular psychological emotional malady that they actually think it's kind of fun to engage in crimes of this nature. I was involved as an assistant detective in one of the cases that you'll hear from one of the individuals who is also, I think, a victim, Mr. Bidwell, Jerry Bidwell from Bidwell and Company, where I had the opportunity to go over to Montana and interview a victim of this same suspect in the Bidwell case, who 25 years after the incident that occurred in Sacramento, California, still had an incredible amount of emotional baggage that she shared with myself and another detective for about an hour and a half. 25 years after this particular individual got her into a car, dressed in a security guard uniform, got her into a car, drove her out into a rural area outside of Sacramento, California, started to take her out into the pucker brush, and this woman began to resist. She was beaten. She was drugged back into her car, into his car, and eventually this particular individual took off as a California Highway Patrol officer was going the other direction on the freeway and saw what he thought was something that was very, very suspicious. And the Highway Patrol officer took off after this particular individual, caught up with him, and the individual got out of the car and began to walk back towards the California Highway Patrolman. And at the same time, this victim, who was handcuffed, got out of the car and started screaming that this person was going to rape and kill her. The particular suspect had no criminal history from that point in California 25 years ago to the point in which he was involved in this allegation, actually was convicted of threatening to harm Mr. Bidwell's children. In that particular case, there was some disclosure by the suspect to a psychologist regarding some of the intent that this particular individual intended to harm these kids, which tended to verify the allegations. And I think that this particular exception to the rule would be helpful in future prosecutions. And I apologize for my testimony. I'm extremely nervous today for some reason.
It's that time of the session, isn't it, Senator?
I think it is. I've got a lot of things. I've got a lot of things on my mind here. So.
Thank you for your testimony, Chairman Minnis. Are there questions for Chairman Minnis about Senate Bill 437?
We have a long list of witnesses, both for and against, that we'll continue to proceed down at some point later in the hearing.
I think, actually, too, I want to say for the committee, I'm a little, maybe I'm a little bit irritated today because some of the opposition that you're going to hear was not raised in the Senate committee, and I found out about it this morning. And some of the individuals who are going to be opposing the bill did not come to me and talk to me after the bill left. In fact, when the bill left and I carried the bill on the floor, the one glaring flaw was the idea that we would have the bill narrowed to the extent that it would deal with violent offenses as opposed to just offenses in general. And then I find today that there's significant opposition to even that particular amendment and that particular narrowing where there would be evidence to commit a future violent crime. So I'm a little bit irritated and upset that some of the professional lobby in this building are now claiming that they didn't know anything about it or didn't discover it until later. So in any event, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly, I think, had a question for you, Mr. Chairman.
No, I just had one question. I wanted to know how my amendment did down the Revenue Committee this morning. And
Well, I was up here.
Oh. Well, you look like that guy that was down in Revenue.
I was.
I'm sorry. It was an impertinent question.
Yeah. ruled out of order. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being with us. We're now going to recess the hearing on Senate Bill 437. We're going to go back up on the agenda to allow Senator Fisher an opportunity to testify to Senate Bill 153. Open a public hearing. Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I won't take but a moment. This particular issue was training for the operators of speed monitoring devices was brought to my attention by a constituent who had been a former patrol officer and had some concerns about the fact that in particular areas of the state, in particular jurisdictions, there was no training offered with the speed measuring devices. And
this day and age when we require people to have insurance, and insurance lots of times is based on the cost, and whether you can get it or not is based upon traffic tickets, I feel that it's very important that those things are as accurate as possible in a responsible manner to our constituents. I was fortunate enough to have the State Patrol take me out and show me some of the speed measuring devices and the problems that could be had with those that didn't know perhaps how to operate them and how to tune them and set them up properly before they started their patrol. And this was a bill, Senate Bill 153A, is a cooperative effort by the State Patrol and others working together that know these speed measuring devices firsthand, and we made it as easy as we could so that there's no particular training course required, so it's not going to require small cities and counties and folks like that to have to go someplace a long way off. They can have training provided by someone in their own department that meets the standards, and so we tried to do the best we could. Apologize, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm nervous this morning, too. I almost hate to leave my office at this time of the session because you never know what's going to have gone astray by the time you get back. And I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Senator Bill Fisher from District 23.
Thank you, Senator.
Douglas County, Josephine and Jackson County.
Thank you. Are there questions for Senator Fisher, Representative Vicki Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm shocked to learn that officers don't have training now. Do they have any kind of training in operating this equipment?
Well, Chair Williams and Representative Walker, some do and some don't. The State Patrol, even though it's not required by law, the State Patrol, from my understanding, trains all of their officers in the use of these. And so it's primarily some sheriff's offices, city offices, things like that, that have not, in some cases, had that training.
And if I follow, it's more than just turning it on and pointing it at the car. There's a little more complicated work to it, isn't there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, yes, I was very interested in that. In the case of radar, it involves the use of tuning forks and the proper sequence of the way they're used and the reading of the instrument as they tune them up before they start out. And I'm not an expert on it, but it would be something that if you weren't trained right, it would be very easy to not have your equipment adjusted properly. And there's also ways of operation on the road. It's very interesting to see these officers and the way they operate. They're very trained. I would get fixated on a vehicle as it was traveling, and he would be checking his own speedometer, checking the radar, and getting his siren for his lights on and everything else while I was still looking at the car and wondering what it was doing. And I'd get back, and I'd find myself glued to the radar speed or something like that, but they have to check the speed that their car's going on the radar at the same time they check the speed of their own speedometer and see if those correlate before they go ahead and proceed on. And there's problems with the radar, especially if there's a batch of vehicles, especially if there's a big truck amongst the vehicles and that kind of thing, or if they're following a big truck fairly close and one thing and another. It's fairly technical, and we did have one instance where an officer admitted that basically his training that he consisted of there's the on and off switch. And so we feel that this is a good bill.
Thank you, Senator, for the education. I appreciate it.
Representative Dingfelter.
Thank you. Actually, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask the same question that Representative Vicki Walker did. But, Senator, I have a question regarding the difference between the original bill and the amended version. There was a section in here for funding for a training program, requiring a training program, and then funding it. From what I read, is that, and that's not included in the engrossed version. So is there no fiscal attached to this time?
Yes. Chair, Representative Dingfelter, I don't believe there is, and that's one thing, as most of you know here, recognize that when a bill gets drafted, lots of times you're looking at it from one angle and you don't have the benefit of having all the rest of the advice and consent of the different parties. And that's why I say this is a good bill, because we brought those parties together and they got rid of the portions in the other bill that would have made it too expensive or inconvenient for the local police departments and things to do. And so we wanted to keep the cost down, yet we wanted them to have the training. And it didn't make any difference to us originally the training was required, and I've forgotten all the initials that go with this and what the acronym stands for, but there's a special training group that does have provide training, but that would be extremely expensive to provide for the smaller districts. And so this allows the city and the sheriff's department to cooperate together or that kind of thing with people in their own department so that they don't have to go away somewhere to take the training or, you know, have to provide somebody especially for this. And so we didn't want to make it expensive. We didn't want to make it difficult. We just wanted to make sure that we've given our citizens a fair deal.
Thank you.
Good. Oh, yes, Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's some deletions in the bill on line 5, and then it goes on to say a speed measuring device. That includes speedometer. That you want them to be trained in how to use a speedometer, in other words, pacing cars.
Vice Chair Krieger, Chair Williams, I think they, and I wasn't part of this. This is the way, to my understanding, that they define all kinds of, whether it's VASCAR radar, LIDAR, any of the uses, whether it's even the aircraft surveillance, they call those speed measuring devices. And I would guess, as much experience as I've had driving, yes, I would guess that actually if you were using a speedometer to pace somebody, there's probably a little bit of training that goes with that, and the fact that that has also visual judgment, and you can be off very easily by your eye if you're not careful and don't have some training, because if you're a quarter of a mile behind somebody, just watch the next time you're out on the road and just see how hard it is to tell whether you're actually catching the person slowly or whether he's maybe pulling away from you slowly. And so I would say that a speedometer probably would also be a speed measuring device, but I would say the training for that wouldn't be as near as complicated as it would for the other, but that's the definition that the officers themselves came up with.
Good, thank you. Any further questions?
Okay, thank you very much, Senator.
Appreciate the courtesy.
You bet. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 153.
Not to mention the comment about the House of Lords.
We know our place, Senator. We're going to reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 437, and I'm going to ask John Bradley and Karen Immergut to come forward, if they would please. Sure. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Karen Immergut, and I apologize. I have terrible laryngitis today. I'm a Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney. I've been a prosecutor on both the federal and state levels for 12 years, and I'm here to testify in support of the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 437 on privilege. I support the bill because I think that the bill would both prevent crimes as well as clarify the admissibility of important evidence when a serious and dangerous crime has been committed. The bill does not require reporting. The bill shields reporters from civil liability. The bill does not delve into past statements that privileges are designed to protect. And the amendments narrow the classes of statements to ones about violent crime. After I reviewed legislation from around the country, this is the clearest approach that we were able to come up with to balance society's need to protect victims of future crime against a defendant's confidentiality interest. This bill reflects the proper balance and sends the clear message that statements revealing an intent to commit a future crime of violence simply are not protected. The legislature in the state of Oregon has carved out various exceptions to the current privileges, and in fact we have 13 privileges in this state. only one. The problem with those exceptions is that they are haphazard and address different issues. Only one, the clinical social worker client privilege, provides that there is no privilege when the communication reveals a clear intent to commit a crime which is reasonably expected to result in physical injury to a person. There is a need for this legislation. This legislation, or the idea for the legislation, came up in a case that Mr. Bradley, first assistant at the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I prosecuted in 1999, which was a case involving charges of solicitation to commit aggravated murder. The defendant in that case was charged with that crime today and went to trial and is convicted because luckily he was unsuccessful in his efforts to kill Jerry Bidwell. The defendant was a disgruntled investor of Bidwell and Company, and his defense was that he was only kidding when he tried to engage in negotiations to kill Jerry Bidwell, which constituted murder for hire. While the case was pending, a psychologist hired by the defendant's own attorney came forward because he wanted the victims warned that the defendant had threatened while in custody that as soon as he was released, and he felt he would be released under the case, he planned to kill Mr. and Mrs. Bidwell and their six children with an AK-47, and he planned to kill the six children in front of Mr. and Mrs. Bidwell in a manner that would be the most harmful. The psychologist was so concerned about that statement that he alerted the defense attorney, who in turn alerted the court. In response to that information and response to the defendant's defense in that case, we subpoenaed the psychologist to come and testify. We had a hearing before Multnomah County Circuit Judge David Gernandt, and eventually Judge Gernandt ruled that the statement was admissible because it included threats to children. And Oregon has a child abuse statute that is an exception to privileges, although it leaves out, ironically, attorney-client privilege. Ironically, if the threat by the defendant in that case had simply been, I'm going to kill Mr. and Mrs. Jerry Bidwell with an AK-47, the statement might not have been admissible, and the defendant, as a result, might not have been convicted. It was very powerful evidence, and especially powerful evidence of the defendant's intent to kill Mr. Bidwell. There is no compelling interest in shielding statements evidencing an intent to commit a future violent crime. Psychologists already have discretion to disclose such statements to proper authorities. Lawyers, already under their ethical rules, have discretion to disclose such statements. The provisions that we are proposing recognize a balancing of society's interest in protection for victims with the individual's right to privacy. Most psychologists, from what we understand, already disclose to patients that there are some statements that they simply will have to disclose if made in the course of the evaluation and treatment. Those are violent crimes, crimes of child abuse, and crimes of elder abuse in particular. The bill imposes no additional duty on psychiatrists, doctors, lawyers to disclose any of those crimes. There is no requirement. A concern raised in the Senate was whether or not prosecutors, as a result of this, or attorneys could engage in a fishing expedition to simply subpoena psychologists or psychiatrists or lawyers in a case. The Oregon Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court has specifically addressed the issue of subpoenaing information on fishing expeditions and has said that that simply cannot be done, that we need to make a substantial showing before a court of law that we have a good faith basis to believe that the communication contains something that is not privileged. Then it will be up to a judge to decide if we have made a sufficient showing, and the court can even review the evidence then in camera to see outside of the presence of a jury or other individuals that would breach the privacy and decide whether or not it falls outside of a privilege. We ask that this committee finds that this bill is the appropriate result for Oregon. It is clear. It sets forth across the board for all privileges except for the clergy penitent privilege, which was carved out already in the Senate. But we ask you to vote for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Immergut. Mr. Bradley?
Chair Williams, my name is John Bradley. I'm the first assistant to the district attorney in Multnomah County, Mike Schrunk. You've been handed out a letter from Mr. Schrunk, who's sorry he can't be here. He has a, as you're aware, I think we're all fighting for our budgets, and he's in a budget meeting this morning. I do want to reiterate what Ms. Immergut said, and that's this. In the Bidwell case, because the defendant said, I'm going to kill the children, he said, I'm going to kill Mr. Bidwell, and I'm going to kill the children. Because he said he was going to kill the children, that's what the judge ruled why the statement was admissible. Had he merely said, I'm going to kill Mr. Bidwell, and I'm going to kill his wife because they were adults, it probably would not have been admissible in Oregon law. And there's no sense in that. I think as Mr. Schrunk said, and we certainly agree, is that the privilege, it's really a weighing that the legislature has to make between the rights of the individuals and the rights of society. And it's important that when you talk about prior conduct, that that's privilege. Nobody has any question about that. Except for future conduct, there's no reason. If somebody says, I'm going to blow up a plane, if somebody says, I'm going to go shoot up a school, society has no interest in shielding those kinds of statements. As I said, the fact that we have a law that says if you say you're going to go, you know, shoot up a school and you can show that the school has children on it, the statement's probably admissible. But if you say I'm going to go, you know, shoot up a college, it might not be. And that's ridiculous to have that type of, you have to look for children to get the statement to be admissible currently in Oregon. One thing on Mike Schrunk's letter, in about the fifth paragraph, he said the primary opposition to the bill comes from psychologists and psychiatrists. And he said, and basically saying that if this bill passes, or that they're saying if this bill passes, it has a chilling effect. And what Mr. Schrunk says, and we certainly agree, is that this bill mandated reporting, said the psychiatrist or psychologist had to report, then that argument might apply. However, what we've done with our amendments is to say this is not an obligation, and that if someone doesn't report, there's no civil liability. This is something in which if somebody really thinks that somebody is going to commit a crime and they feel a moral obligation, they can go ahead and try to stop it. And also what it says, and what Mr. Schrunk says, and again, we agree with it, it says that, first of all, if a doctor just decide I never want to report these things, they never have the obligation to report it. They don't have to change any practice that is currently being done, because this bill makes these things an option on the part of the doctor. And the second thing is, and this is, I think, is so important, is if somebody says, I'm going to go out and kill somebody, I'm going to go out and blow up something, the first thing the doctor can say is, you know, try to talk the person out of it. And if the person insists that they're going to do it, then the doctor can come forward and say, look, if you do this and you leave this office with that attitude, I'm going to have to report you, and I don't want you doing it. Again, another reason that it kind of shields the doctor and gives doctors alternatives. What this is to prevent future crimes of violence. I think Senator Menas was correct. When this came up in the Senate, There was opposition, and the primary opposition was it was too broad because it might include things like drugs and drug treatments, and those are things we have no interest in. I mean, the fact that someone goes into a doctor and says, you know, I think I want to take drugs in the future, we don't have an interest in this. What we said is we were willing to say, let's just, you know, let's focus in on violent offenses. Now, the reason why it has sex abuse in the bill, in the amendments rather, is because if somebody says, I'm going to have sex with children, it may not be violent. And therefore, what we put in it, we said, involving sex. And that's the reason why, because it might not be a crime of violence. It might be a crime of age. And again, the other compromise we made this with the Oregon State Bar, was to make this discretionary and to make sure and clear that it was discretionary on the part of the person who was involved in the privilege. I mean, that was important to the bar, and we said, all right, we can live with that. And that's why when you see the A3 amendments, it is the result of compromise. And when we met with the psychiatrists and psychologists, and the question was asked, is there anything that could be done here to make this more palatable? They want to be taken out altogether. And we suggest is that, as what I want to say is, this does not put an obligation on psychiatrists or psychologists. It gives them a potential avenue when they think something is so serious. We made sure that the bill said they have to have the belief that this is something that's going to happen. And in that situation, it gives them the alternative. If they think it's the thing to do, they can go forward, report it. And then if in fact is something happens and somebody is killed or some plane is blown up, they can testify against the person. It's not the bill that passed the Senate. It was a result of a lot of hard work between ourselves and the Oregon State Bar. And I don't think I really...
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bradley, I believe that you testified earlier that you could not get in trouble for not disclosing a person who could have waived the privilege but did not, could not get into trouble. There was no liability for the non-disclosure. But as I look at the Dash 3 amendments, it actually says the opposite. The person who discloses a communication is not liable to any other person for damage or injury arising out of the disclosure. In other words, there doesn't seem to be clear protection for non-disclosure, at least not that's articulated in this bill, and I wonder if you would comment on that, please.
Chair Williams, Representative Blow. That's the provision in which somebody does report. It's subsection 3 where it said the provisions of this bill do not create a duty to report any communication to any person. And we in the Oregon State Bar felt that was sufficient to protect the person from a non-disclosure. If the committee has problems and wants to be more specific, saying that there is no liability for failure to disclose, I have no objection to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lowe, if I might also respond, the current section which allows for discretionary disclosure on the part of a certain large class of psychologists is under ORS 179.505, subsection 12. And in that section, it does say that providers, if a communication indicates a clear and immediate danger to others or to societies, they may be reported to the appropriate authority, and the bill specifically says a decision not to disclose information under this subsection shall not subject the provider to civil liability. So we felt that that was already covered on behalf of the psychologist.
I'm concerned about other people for whom the privilege is going to become somewhat leakier under this bill. And I'm wondering if it might be advisable to clearly articulate that non-disclosure doesn't expose you to liability either.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That wasn't going to be my comment except to say that I think we did have this conversation in my office last week, and it seems to me that symmetry would probably be a good thing to put in here just for drafting purposes, where one refers to not civilly liable and the other one refers to no duty to report. It seems to me if we mean them to say the same thing, we ought to say them the same way. And the other, I guess, I want to get back at, if I may, Ms. Emmergut, I think you addressed the process involving a subpoena of a psychologist or somebody to whom the privilege applies, and the in-camera kind of balancing and examination. Would that necessarily apply under this bill? Because it seems to me under sub 1, it just says that it is not there is no privilege. So I'm wondering what is the balancing at that point? And then I guess I would posit that maybe if we change sub 3, the problem goes away. But where it says there is no duty to report, I'm wondering if that's true if a psychologist, psychiatrist, doctor, whomever the case may be, receives a subpoena. Does the subpoena trump the language in sub 3 that says there's no duty? But again, if we're going to change no duty to say no civil liability, that may cover that. But I guess going back to that first one, why would there be that balancing and that in-camera kind of evaluation where the statute here simply says there is no privilege?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, the United both the Oregon Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court have analyzed under various existing privileges, as well as actually just subpoenaing in general in criminal cases. As recently as March of this year, the Oregon Court of Appeals in State versus Cartwright held that when information is subpoenaed from a third party in a case, that this balancing takes place, that we need a good faith belief that the material sought is both material and favorable to our case. And we would have to, if that third party moves to quash the subpoena, then it would come before a court and we would have to make such a showing. So it actually does not apply specifically to the privileges or exceptions to the privileges, but that's the routine when we subpoena information from a third party. In addition, there currently exists a crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege rule, and through case law established from the Oregon Supreme Court in United States versus Zolan, adopted by the Oregon Supreme Court in Freeze versus Glazer, we have adopted that kind of balancing, that the party subpoenaing information that could arguably be privileged has to go through that balancing test, and it's not provided in the in the exception by statute, but it is provided by the case law.
Further questions? Thank you both for testifying.
Thank you.
I've been neglectful. It wasn't until just a moment ago that I recognized Representative Barnhart, sitting back in the back there. Representative, if you'd like to come testify, I believe, is this the bill you wish to testify on?
The lawyer psychologist.
Right.
Can't ask for much better.
And I'm sorry that I called you Representative Bates. My apologies. Both of you are slightly follically impaired, and it just got the better of
me. Oh. You're digging deeper, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from District 40. I'm here essentially to oppose this bill, but I think more important than that, to talk a little bit about the rules as I understand them currently to be in the area of psychology. And someone correctly stated that I'm a lawyer and also a psychologist. I practiced law in Eugene for about 7 years before I went back to school and became a psychologist. And I practiced psychology, including mostly forensic psychology, for about 15 years before getting involved in this enterprise. So I'm familiar with the ethics rules, the statutes relating to confidentiality or relating to privilege. I taught continuing education classes on ethics, confidentiality, and privilege. I've also been a member of the Oregon State of the Board of Psychology Examiners for 2.5 years prior to the time that I came to the legislature. So this is a subject that I know something about, in addition to having a chance to vote on it if it should reach the floor in the legislature. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between confidentiality and privilege, which is something I think most of the members of the committee probably are very familiar with, but in case any of you aren't, I wanted to cover that just in a very brief way. Privilege, of course, is the legal concept that allows for a litigant or some other person in appropriate circumstance to prevent someone else from presenting information that might otherwise be probative in the case to a court. In the case of Oregon, of course, we have this long privilege statute in ORS 40. It's in the bill 40.225 to 40.295, in which a whole variety of different privileges are established. These privileges, of course, belong to the person who revealed the information in a privileged context, not to the professional. And so, of course, the person whose information it is could waive the privilege simply by saying so. The privilege only applies in court or in other legal proceedings. It doesn't apply in other situations. For example, a casual conversation or communications between professionals or in some other way. That area is covered by the confidentiality rules that are part of the ethical requirements of every profession. They vary from absolutely no communication, as in the priest penitent privilege, to or the clergy penitent privilege, as we call it, to the to a much more open rule in other professions based on the need. In Oregon, the psychotherapist patient privilege is found in ORS 40.230, and there are specific exceptions to this privilege which are found in 40.230 sub 4 sub B, which you might want to review as you're looking at this area. The privilege in the psychotherapist patient privilege already has a lot of holes in it based on the current statute. And information which is germane to a case and which relates to the mental or emotional condition of a person who's involved in the litigation can come in spite of the psychotherapist patient privilege. So in effect, there's no privilege already to communications that are relevant to the issue before the court. In most situations in Oregon under the current law. The confidentiality rule, as followed by psychology at least, is a very interesting one, and it's based on an idea, the idea of balancing the needs of the patient and the psychotherapist-patient relationship to actually talk about secrets, to deal with secrets in a way which is open in the context of the treatment, but closed from the rest of the world. On the one side, that's one set of issues, and of course it's extremely important to the psychotherapeutic process that there be a closed and safe environment within which people can deal with their shibboleths and dragons in order to be able to handle them more appropriately in other contexts of their lives. That's, after all, a big chunk of what psychotherapy is about. On the other side, psychologists recognize the responsibility that psychologists have to other members of the society beyond their patients, and, of course, to their patients as well, and to the extent that their actions may relate to controlling a patient's behavior, who is out of control now, but who might very well later regret his or her behavior in that context. So it's quite common and understood ethically that psychotherapists are going to violate confidentiality for the purpose of obtaining help for a patient who is unable to care for himself or might be dangerous to himself or others. In accordance with the laws that we regularly have in the area of civil commitment, for example. It's also understood, especially since the Tarasoff case in California, that psychologists have an obligation to violate confidentiality in situations in which warning a person of a serious danger or taking some other steps to protect another person from serious danger might be the appropriate action to take. The Tarasoff case, if you'll recall, was a case involving a murder in California in which a psychologist became aware of a significant threat from one of his patients to a young woman who was a student at the University of California at Berkeley. The psychologist tried to get the patient committed as a danger to others, was unsuccessful in doing that, and the result of it was that the young lady was murdered. In California then, on the basis of case law, it became established that the psychologist had the duty to warn the young woman and her family. And I will tell you that even though this case has never been replicated in Oregon, that Oregon psychologists understand this case very well. They understand that they have an obligation to act in situations such as this one to take care of or to deal with those kinds of imminent dangers. Now, to this bill. The bill does not really apply to any of the things that I've just been talking about. It simply deals with the privilege situation. And in most of the context that I can imagine, the ending of the privilege is only going to apply in contexts in which a harm has already occurred. we don't put people in jail as a, for violation of criminal statutes because they think that they might commit a crime sometime in the future. We may take some other action, but we're not going to do that. So my perception of this bill, at least, is that it it does not accomplish anything useful in terms of actually preventing bad behavior on the part of psychotherapy patients. Now, a couple of comments were made in the testimony immediately ahead of me, in which it talked about the idea that this bill would give an option to a doctor, and I think I'm quoting, he can decide never to report anything and not be liable. Well, as a former member of the Board of Psychology Examiners, that would disturb me a great deal, because the psychology ethical rules have been very carefully balanced to compare or consider the needs, the psychotherapy needs, the privacy needs of a patient against the needs of other members of, their, of our society. And there are times, as I've pointed out, when it's a psychologist's obligation to violate confidentiality. If this bill, in effect, says that a psychologist can't be liable for failing to violate confidentiality when it's appropriate for the psychologist to do so, then I would oppose the bill on that basis, as well as on the basis that I think it opens a bigger hole in the privilege statute than currently exists. In that context, I think it upsets the current law as adopted through administrative rule by the Board of Psychology Examiners and is understood, I think, generally by psychology. I will tell you that one of the continuing education requirements that psychologists have in Oregon now is a 4 hours of continuing education in the area of ethics every 2 years, and you have to report that in order to get your license. One of the things that's always covered in this area is this topic that I just covered with you in just a couple of minutes about the difference between privilege and confidentiality. The requirements of confidentiality and the requirements when it's important to break confidentiality in order to protect the public or specific members of the public. In my view, this bill, at least as it may apply to psychologists, is a problem looking for a solution, and may in fact, in the attempts to fix it, may in fact upset the capacity of the Board of Psychologists Examiners or others to enforce their ethical rules to require disclosure in the appropriate situation. Thank you, and I'll stop there and take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Are there questions for Representative Barnhart? Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, the case in California that you were talking about, I'm a little bit confused. That's case law now that applies to California, or
yes,
does it apply to Oregon as well?
Well, let me respond to it this way. Literally speaking, it applies to California. In fact, what it is a very reasoned argument about why the common law tort law, should establish a duty for a psychotherapist to warn an individual who's in danger as a result of the threats made by a patient. I think psychologists consider it to be compelling, and I think for the most part psychologists understand that even though this may not literally be the law of the state of Oregon or of other states, we're going to behave as if it is.
I need to follow up because I'm confused. Who do they have the duty to report to law enforcement or to the person who...
It depends on what would be most efficacious. If, for example, an individual were to say, I'm going to rob the Lash National Bank Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock, then the psychotherapist might be in a position where the appropriate thing to do would be to warn the police or the bank itself. I mean, it depends on the circumstances.
So how is this bill different? I mean, other than the fact
the bill
that
does not
liability.
The bill waives privilege.
Okay.
It's a different issue.
Further questions?
Thank you.
And yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd now like to call forward Frank Calistro and Mr. Bidwell.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Calistro, I know we're keeping you away from your duties at the state hospital, so we'll have you testify so you can get back to those duties. Am I right about that?
It's actually the state penitentiary, but thank you.
All right, well, wherever you're at, wherever your duties take you.
I came here from prison today. Briefly, I'm a psychologist in private practice in Portland. Part of that practice is just the general sort of counseling, individual and family counseling that we all do. A bigger part of it is consultation with state DOC, various law enforcement agencies, the defense bar, and various district attorney's offices, mainly in the area of violence, threat assessment, risk assessment. That's my area of specialty. That's why I'm here to speak in support of this bill. I think it does three important things for us. First of all, it codifies our existing ethical standards regarding duty to report. Second, I guess it's the most important issue, is it does promote community